Hello everyone and welcome to the latest episode of the Belgian Football Podcast. My name is Scott Coyne and I'll be your host for this episode. This is our latest special episode and what a special it is. And a rather familiar but at the same time slightly unusual guest because we're welcoming the BFP's founder and host Ben Jackson, who, as many of you will know by now, has just had his debut book published, just within the last few hours, in fact, by the wonderful Pitch Publishing, who publish probably the best football books going at the moment. Many of you will already have titles by them on your bookshelf, but Ben's debut book, The Africa Cup of Nations, History of an Underappreciated Tournament, is now available, and we'll give you all the details on how to get a copy shortly if you haven't already. So Ben, welcome to your own podcast.
Honestly, man, it's such a strange thing to do, especially hearing you do the intro and me just sitting here. That's just strange. Nah, it's good to have a familiar face to talk to about the book. Yeah, looking forward to it. We've been talking about doing this for a long time, so it's nice to, and feels strange actually, finally be here talking about it and it's actually out, which, yeah, just feels very, very bizarre.
Yeah, there's always such a massive build-up to the release of a book because, you know, they're a long time in gestation, as you're going to tell us a bit more about shortly. But, you know, the stars are kind of aligning for you in a number of ways here because the book is published just a few hours ago, yesterday in fact, as of recording, and the latest AFCON 23, even though we are in 24, Ben will tell us all about that. It's not me making a mistake, I promise. AFCON's about to kick off imminently on the 13th of January, of course, so the timing of this couldn't really be better. Ivory Coast is just about to host its second tournament. It'll be the 34th AFCON, so it's an absolutely perfect time to get a hold of this book. What we've decided to do, actually, is, as well as celebrating the launch of the book and previewing some of its contents and why you should get a copy, we also wanted to give this a uniquely Belgian slant, because we are the Belgian Football Podcast, after all, and there is a really close historic link between Belgian and African football as well, so we thought we'd drill down on that a little bit, as well as discussing the book. So how does it feel to finally be out?
Yeah, well, it's really, really strange. It is really, really strange, especially like waking up on New Year's Day and being like, my book's out today. But all the shops are closed, so you can't go and find it or do anything about it. It's just kind of, it's there somewhere. It is kind of that strange feeling of like, you've reached the end of like a process that's been going on for quite some time. And it's like, I really enjoyed the process of it. And it's actually left me feeling a little bit empty when it finished and I handed it in, because it's like you've done something, you finished it now, and it's like, okay, now what? Like, because I finished it a couple of months ago and then handed it over to Pitch, and they've done like the fantastic work that they do and kind of cleaning everything up, making sure you've made the, like, kind of named people right and done all that sort of stuff, like really, really thorough. And then it's just, that's it. You're like, you know it's coming. You're kind of going back and forth about a title, and then it's, yeah, not a title, the images and stuff like that. And yeah, then you're like, well, now what? Like, I'm just waiting for this thing to come out, and it's just the slow build-up. But it's nice, and it's like, I'm obviously buzzing for the tournament. Yeah, the year thing, confusing for everyone, confusing when you're trying to write about it as well, because you're kind of referencing dates, but you're also referencing a tournament that's like a year out of date, because this isn't the first time this has happened. I'm hoping people enjoy it. I think that's kind of the other thing. You kind of... it's out there now, you're kind of waiting to see, do people actually like this? Like, do people actually enjoy this? Like, is it what people are expecting? Is it not what they're expecting? Like, that's the whole kind of, because I know what I've written and I've known kind of like how I've told the story, but there's so many different ways to tell the story of AFCON. Like, there's not, what I've said is not the only way. There's stuff I've definitely missed out because of limits and stuff, and I'm sure we'll probably touch on that, but it's kind of like now you're waiting to see if people actually like it. And if they don't, you're kind of a little bit terrified. Because obviously, yeah, especially since it's the first book as well. Because like for me, it's like, yeah, like do people enjoy how I write? Do people like what I've written? Like, it's, yeah, it's quite interesting. Especially it's like, especially with some of the books from Pitch that people would have read before, like the quality is really, really high. And maybe we'll touch on another couple of books that kind of inspired me to do this one. But some of the like most of the stuff I've read from Pitch, I'm always coming out of it thinking, yeah, this is well researched, but also really well written. So you're hoping that people read this and think, yeah, this is another great pitch publication, rather than like, oh, like, this isn't quite what I was looking for. But that's just kind of the way I look at lots of different things. So fingers crossed people will actually enjoy it.
Well, I'm sure it'll be very positively received, because a book like this is long overdue. There are some other books in English on elements of African football, but this is really the kind of first book in English that takes the history of the tournament, both the football side of things, but also the politics, because, you know, obviously you've brought these two together in the book, which is one of the things that I like most about the book, because, you know, this is, you know, the old argument about, can you separate, you know, football from politics? I think we would both probably agree you can't, and, you know, you shouldn't. And this book kind of, you know, celebrates that, but also, you know, brings out lots of hidden histories as well. So in terms of, you know, the seeds of the book, tell us a little bit about, you know, the background to that, because you're no stranger to African politics and sociology, really, are you?
No, yeah. So for those that don't know, there are probably a lot of people that don't know, because it just is what it is. But yeah, so my like kind of degree was in African politics. I did my master's at SOAS in London in African politics. So like a long kind of running story that stems from basically in 2011, I visited Sierra Leone, became fascinated in the country. And it was a footballing trip that we went on. Like, we went there, just a random group of friends. It wasn't like a externally organized trip that you get from like World Fit Challenge, I think it's called, and stuff like that. This was just one of our mates had a family friend who was an air hostess, who made friends with some priests in Sierra Leone, who then invited us over to do some football coaching in the local village near the airport. And then after that, it kind of spiraled until, yeah, eventually I did this master's in African politics. And it's also kind of where my interest in Belgian football comes from massively, is because of the African angle, like you mentioned, Scott. And we'll definitely talk about these close links and how a lot of players have come and started their careers, especially from Africa, in Belgium. Like, it's a really, really strong kind of link between the two. So I've always been interested in like the African politics, African history, African football. So you bring them all together, you get AFCON, basically. But in terms of writing a book, it actually comes after we had that really great chat with James Kelly about his book Golden. And if you haven't read that, you really need to read it. It's a fantastic book on Belgian footballing history. And just like hearing how he talked about the process of it all and working with pitch and stuff, I was like, oh, I'd love to do something like that. And I'd love to do something I'm passionate about, which is African history. I've always been wanting to write some stuff on African history. So yeah, then I went looking to see, like, has anyone written about the history of AFCON not in English? There's a German book, and then there's a really, I can always forget his name, but there's a really famous guy. I think he's Tunisian or Algerian, who just watched the tournament during the 80s and 70s and 80s, and he just explained everything that was going on, but nothing in English. So obviously you bring that into it. And then I think as well for like AFCON, and you're seeing it already in terms of this year, it's like, it's always been considered more of a nuisance than like a celebration of football internationally. It's always been seen as like, oh, it comes in the middle of our European season and it disrupts everything, blah, blah, blah. And they did try to change it. They tried to move it to the summer, but the climate just doesn't work for that, which is why you've now got this tournament that says AFCON 2023, but it's taking place in 2024. You had the same with Cameroon, the previous tournament, like, same, the name was already there because it's already sponsored, like the sponsorship's already there for the name, but they just move it to the next year. So it's this really weird situation. So this is AFCON 2023, but it's in 2024. But there's no kind of like celebration that, in terms of like, oh, this isn't it great that these players are going to represent their country. It's more, isn't this annoying for the domestic side? Like, we've seen it in Belgian football already, like Hein van Heijsenbeek at Gent already kind of bemoaning not getting any compensation. But then Union put out a tweet saying, congratulations to Lazar Armani, like, so proud of you getting to go and represent your country. So it's kind of like, we could slowly get there. And it's nice to see there is kind of a pushback from people, especially kind of in the social media football kind of sphere, on like, we need to respect these tournaments more, like the AFCON and the Asia Cup, and just appreciate that these are some of the best players in the world, but they're getting to represent their country. And it's that I found came out a lot during, like, looking back over the tournaments, listening to kind of even just press conferences and hearing players and coaches speak about how important this is to them to play in this tournament, to represent their country in this tournament. And I think trying to show that through the book as well, to be like, look, this isn't just some Mickey Mouse tournament that everyone kind of routinely takes the mick out of, because you'll see, and we'll see it during this tournament, you'll notice it as well. Like, there'll be videos popping up of something bizarre happening in African football that would have maybe happened a decade ago. But then one of those like clickbait accounts will be like, look what's going on over in the Ivory Coast during this AFCON tournament. And it's like, well, that's actually not going on now. And that happened 10 years ago. Like, it's just, and I've seen it, like, it gets regurgitated. So that's why I call it underappreciated in terms of a tournament, because while there's lots of people who, like me, like, enjoy watching African football, people within the continent obviously are passionate about this tournament. Like, there are still discussions within the countries themselves about whether it should be every 2 years, whether it should be this and that, because obviously you've got massive European football followings. But I think it deserves a lot more respect in terms of its quality, in terms of kind of how important it is to the players and the coaches and the fans. And I think that's kind of where I was like, yeah, this needs to be written, because this tournament deserves its own kind of appreciation as a historic tournament alongside the likes of the Euros, Asia Cup, World Cup, like all these big international tournaments. That AFCON is one of these, and it deserves its kind of place there. So yeah, kind of long-winded way of saying that, like, all these kind of ideas came into my head, and then you start writing it, and then you're kind of starting to get someone I work with, an academic I work with, always calls it kind of imposter syndrome, where you're like, why am I writing this? Why is it me telling this story? Why isn't anyone else telling this story? And that was really, I found that really difficult to deal with, because I was like, why am I doing this? Like, this is for me just a passion project that I'm enjoying. And it's something like I get to do, and I get to learn the history of the tournament myself while writing it. But it's like, am I the right person to do this in this age where it's kind of like white power and all that sort of stuff? And yeah, as a white man, should I be writing the history of an African football tournament? And I don't have the answer to that question, in terms of I've never really come to that conclusion whether that was the right thing or not to do. But I've not had any backlash from people saying you shouldn't have done this. It should have been coming from someone with more direct links to Africa. So hopefully it will be well appreciated. But I just want people to understand, obviously, this is some, like, it's just this internal battle. And I'm sure lots of other authors, like, I'm sure James probably had that when he wrote his book on Belgian football. Like, should this be coming from me? Should it be coming from someone who's actually Belgian? So it's just one of those things, isn't it? And maybe someone else will come along and write another book on AFCON history from within the actual continent. But yeah, a long-winded answer to your question there, Scott, because it's just one of those things I've just been like really trying to, when you sent me those questions over, like, how, where did this come from? And kind of, that's kind of the internal kind of discussions I've had with myself and like the reasoning behind it.
Yeah, it's really interesting a lot what you were saying there, Ben, because you know, you're talking about the emphasis on the tournament being underappreciated outside of Africa generally, which I think most football fans would agree about. And unless you know have spent time in some of these countries or are from Africa yourself, I think it's very difficult to appreciate quite how big a deal the tournament actually is in these home nations. You know, you see these little things on social media, like you say, at the time, which are always fascinating, and some of them are really entertaining. But I suppose this is a big deal. And I think what the book will do undoubtedly is help draw more attention to the tournament and help people find out more about it, and hopefully improve the appreciation and respect for the tournament, which it certainly deserves. Because as you said, I think it does need and deserve much more respect. So in terms of your kind of process with the book, how did you basically decide to approach it sort of structurally? Because obviously it's a huge, huge subject. So how do you pick that apart?
Really difficult. Really, really difficult. I think what people hopefully should remember, when if they do get it and they read it, is like, you may be like, oh, where's this team? Where's that team? And it's like, you're given a limit on how much you can write. And I went over, like, pitch were like, this is how many words you've got to use, like, this is a framework. And it's like, you do have some leeway, like people that have done university essays, you know, you always get a little bit of leeway. But I was going over because I was like, there's just so much incredibly interesting content here. And I think it probably speaks a little bit to, I think, like, from, like, if you think about it, like, me and you, obviously, Scott, we are English or UK based people who are very interested in Belgian football. Like, that's quite niche. So we kind of, there's tangential things, like if someone says something, we'll be like, oh, that's really interesting. Let's kind of tangent that towards kind of what we're interested in. So I'd be writing about one year and I'd see a player name come up, and he'd have played for, like, especially with the Belgian, there's always players playing for like Eintracht Alst. There's so many random players playing for Eintracht Alst, and I'd just be like, what is this about? And that's what I think I was sending you guys, like, who is this team nicknamed the Onions? Like, why have they got so many African players? And it's like, no, right, back to the focus, because not many other people care about the Onions. Like, they'll care more about the player and what's happening in that. So I had a really good chat, I think, with Peter Alagai, who is a professor in football history, especially African football history, over in the States. And he was saying that how, just try and remember what people will want, people will find interesting, and make sure it tells that narrative and it is interesting to people. So I was like, okay, like, how do I structure this? I wanted to do it chronological because I thought that's just the easiest way to kind of map everything out. But unfortunately, because of the way I did it, a couple of teams miss out. So Tunisia and Morocco, they've won a tournament each, but I didn't quite find a way to fit their wins in because it didn't really work. So I start initially with kind of the first tournament, because I think that's a really important period of time, like the first couple of tournaments where you've just got three nations, well, technically four nations, but if you read it, you'll find out why it ends up just being three nations coming together to play a tournament in Sudan. And it's just the evolution of that until suddenly you get to the 60s and Ghana enter. And when Ghana enter, everything kind of shifts and you see this first kind of impact of, I guess, the original sports washing, but not in the way that we know it today. So obviously for many people, sports washing is what we see with Middle Eastern clubs or teams. Equatorial Guinea have been quite prone to some sports washing recently, like kind of let's improve our image and then people kind of not care about the human rights stuff. Whereas for Ghana, it was more about Kwame Nkrumah, the first president, comes in and he's like, how can we improve our image within Africa and globally? He's like, football. He just loved football. Like, you have Stanley Matthews going over there to play a game, it's kind of like celebration of independence. And he really did connect with the Ghanaian national team during the 60s. So I was like, well, that's a perfect period. Like, let's look at the 60s. Let's look at Ghana. Then the DRC come in, Mbutu, similar kind of idea to Nkrumah. Like, he wants this team to be kind of representative of him, change the name to the Leopards. If people know Mbutu, always wore a leopard hat. Like, it's very kind of these links. There's a fantastic book called Zaire 74, which again, kind of, if you read that book, you'll realize again how what happened at that World Cup with Zaire wasn't what we've always been portrayed to think it was, in terms of they didn't understand the rules, they didn't understand this and that. Like, it had nothing to do with them not understanding the rules, but then they did that free kick. It's the political background stuff that's going on with Mobutu, but I wanted to look at the 70s. I wanted to look at Zaire because I think they're such an incredibly important team, especially when it comes to like sub-Saharan Africa and how they make the World Cup. And Ghana, in my opinion, probably should have made the World Cup, but the kind of football was very much against Africa at that point, especially FIFA, Stanley Roos very much against kind of the development of African football. They weren't allowing them to kind of connect. So we start there. Go through to the 70s. Then we get to the 80s. Has to be Cameroon. I was like, Cameroon are just, they were the team of the 80s. Roger Miller, all those guys. Unfortunately, Cameroon then miss out a bit later when we have a really dominant 90s, 2000s Cameroon team. And after basically Cameroon in the 80s, it was quite difficult to then pick teams from eras. Because I think apart from the one I'll talk about in a second, you just have more stories than you do eras because their teams aren't as dominant. Like you have an emerging Nigeria team, you have kind of Algeria, you have all these other teams starting to emerge. But I had to pick South Africa in 96. That's a really poignant moment. One of the more interesting stories as well. And Peter himself has written so much about this. So he's definitely one to check out if you're more interested in getting deeper into like South African footballing history, because basically they don't appear at all in the book until 96. That's when they really kind of come through. Then 2000s looked at Egypt, that most dominant team. Kind of when I was growing up, I knew if someone said AFCON to me as a kid, I'd just think of Egypt. They just were the two I put together. So I kind of then finished off the eras then, and I was like, because basically since Egypt win three in a row, what you find with the AFCON is it's just more individual teams starting to kind of rise and fall as the playing like kind of the level just gets so even. You've got great Ivory Coast teams, you've got strong Nigeria, strong Ghana, Algeria coming back, Morocco starting to return now, Senegal, like you have all these teams emerge. So it's kind of like I bounced around a little bit more in terms of there's some historical stuff that really links to the like the more present day stuff. So yeah, it was quite difficult to fit it all in and not kind of go too broad and try and dive in. So there's some chapters I really did enjoy doing, especially in those later bits where I could bounce around a little bit more, like Zambia I found fascinating. Massive links with Belgian football as well, Zambia. Nigeria, again, links with Belgian football. Especially as like I felt like when my Nigeria chapter, like Stephen Keshi was the focal point for me, former Anderlecht man who he's just there throughout like kind of 80s, early 90s. And then he comes back as a coach and leads them to victory. Like he's just such an interesting guy. Tragically loses his life at the age of 56. But yeah, then you get all the way up to Algeria, Senegal, all these other teams. So it's kind of, I found it quite tricky. I felt bad leaving out Tunisia and Morocco. And there's other teams I'd love to have looked more at, but they were quite hard to do. It was like Sudan and Ethiopia, some of the earlier teams that both won tournaments. But it's a lot easier to find information and research on the later tournaments than it is the early tournaments. But it's kind of like a bounce around a little bit near the end, but I'm hoping that it kind of does work for people. Kind of we go through the eras and then the more modern era, people probably do know a little bit more about the tournament from kind of the player migration to Europe and stuff like that. So these are players that they would have known about and may have followed at these tournaments a little bit more, but not so much in like the 80s and 70s and stuff. So yeah, I hope that kind of gives people an idea of how I'd structured this thing, but it wasn't easy to like not talk about everything because there is just so much that happened during these tournaments. And there's probably stuff I missed that people would be like, if only that story had been in there. But at the end of the day, you're so limited when you're doing something like this to not make it ridiculously long, and then it would be quite boring for people to kind of trudge through it over weeks and months rather than, yeah, a little bit shorter.
That's the amazing thing about, you know, a subject as big and as wide as this, that you obviously when you're in the middle of the process, you're kind of self-editing a little bit as you go, and sometimes going down alleys you don't expect, and obviously things sometimes come up during research, doesn't it, that you think, oh, this is fascinating, I have to find out more about this, and then that kind of grows arms and legs and becomes, you know, a chapter in an area that you sort of didn't expect. But you must have had a lot of fun researching this, because you know I know you had a couple of trips and you must have spent a fair bit of time watching some old YouTube footage and great games of the past.
Yeah, no, 100%. It's great that some, I don't know where these people get these like images and the video from these games, but massive thanks to them. Like lots of accounts that I can't pronounce because a lot of them were in kind of Arabic. I think it was a lot of Moroccan, Algerian and Egyptian accounts on YouTube that just had all the tournament available to them. So that was always really, really fascinating. There is some footage from those really early games and like some ridiculously good goals. And yeah, I did do a couple of, so I went to Zurich, of course, like why wouldn't you go to Zurich if you're researching on African football? But the FIFA Museum, they fantastic people that work there in the library section, and if you ever do want to do a book or anything like that, definitely reach out to them because they were just amazing. I kind of got in touch with them and they just brought out boxes and boxes and boxes of kind of like correspondence between FIFA and CAF, but also like old programs, old match reports, like really, really retro match reports and stuff, which a lot of the stories from that I couldn't include that I'd love to include, but I did include a couple from like the qualifying rounds where just hilarious things happened that I was just like, this is mental. Like, I won't spoil any of them, but there are a couple of stories that came out of that. I was like, this is just ridiculous. And I was just kind of sat in the library, like, what is going on? And then kind of, it was less in terms of these weren't like kind of planned trips, but I did spend some time in South Africa, the Seychelles and Morocco. Not in terms of directly for writing this book, because unfortunately I don't have all the money in the world to do something like that. And obviously I'd have loved to have traveled to all these countries, but it's just not feasible in this situation or in the position I was in. But while I'm in these countries on doing other things, it's kind of like speaking to people and kind of like get kind of the idea of how people view the tournament, how people view their national team. Especially in the country like the Seychelles, I found that like it was very easy to get places. Like, we ended up going to the FA, went into the National Stadium, and it was just like, as if, like, it was just a very normal thing. Whereas obviously Morocco is quite different. Whereas speaking to guys in Marrakesh and the souks, kind of in the football shirt shops and stuff like that, kind of like seeing who they think is going to win the tournament, what they think of like Morocco's footballing history, like, it is really interesting. And then with South Africa as well, like, I was quite lucky. I've got some colleagues who are South African, and through that, like, a project that I do at work, there's some Ghanaians as well. So I was speaking to them kind of about the older players, the older generation of players, and kind of hearing the theories on how such and such's dad was always a better player than his son was, but his dad just played like the local league sort of level, even like Ghanaian Premier League, just played local league, but he was great and he could have made it, but he didn't because the time period was different and stuff. So yeah, it was really interesting speaking to people. I'd love to have spoken to way more people than I was able to, but it's just kind of, I found it quite difficult at sometimes trying to like convince people to give up their time. And it's quite difficult when you're not really able to give them anything in return, especially within footballing circles, which can be really closed. And we've known in when we've done our Belgian stuff, like, you're very reliant on people being willing to give you the time of day, willing to open the door for you. And lots of people were, but not all the time. And that's where, obviously, kind of going back to the Belgian stuff, that's where what's been so great about for us doing this podcast, isn't it? It's just like, lots of teams have been really open to us, and that just makes it worthwhile, because we don't like kind of feel like obliged to give them anything in return. It just helps us. It helps them like push their team and stuff like that. So yeah, that has been quite interesting in that sense of like, how much access can you get? And now you're probably more likely to get access now that you've had the book published and stuff like that, and you're kind of a little bit more credible. But it's kind of like, it'd been great to have been more credible a little bit earlier to get kind of the chat and stuff that you want. But it is what it is, and it's just kind of, you can still get people's opinions. It's just, you get them from press conferences, you get them from interviews that they've done with other people, and it's kind of that secondary source research. But that's where sitting in the FIFA museum and doing that kind of first-hand research, looking at kind of the correspondence, looking at these match reports and kind of all these other things, it was fascinating to kind of see the evolution of African football, the evolution of CAF, and the relationship between the two bodies. Very, very different back then to how it is now, I'd definitely say.
Yeah, I remember when you were doing that research, would be months ago now, I remember you getting in touch with me and Joris going, you guys, you won't believe it. I've just kind of come across, you know, pulling things out in that archive. And that's one of the joys, I think, of researching a book. It's those little surprises and those little bits of actual living history that sometimes you get in your hands as well. One of the things I love about the book, actually, is, you know, as I was saying back at the beginning, the way that actually you combine, you know, a broad sweep chronological history of the tournament with the politics in these individual countries as well, and how that's kind of impacted the tournament. You know, you were talking about your own background in African politics way back at the beginning as well. And was that a deliberate choice before you started any of the writing, that you thought, I'm going to take this approach, I'm going to tell the story of the history of the tournament, but I'm going to get in as much of the political situation in each country as possible, because you can't separate them?
Yeah, I think, like, looking back, I'd probably like to have done it a lot more, but it's kind of then what it is, kind of like knowing who wants to read this. Is it just football fans? Is it people that are interested in African politics? Is that sort of like, kind of, I don't want to bore people with the politics, but then I think people have to remember that this tournament is kind of emerging and developing over a time period where lots of African nations are like kind of coming out of the colonial era. They're fighting for their independence. They've gained their independence. And these like kind of African leaders have now inherited these states that never actually existed before the colonial period. In many cases, like, the boundaries are artificially kind of put together. And now you've suddenly got a country, and it's like, well, how do you govern a country? And I think everyone knows that football can bring people together. Like, it can push people apart, like, but it can bring them together. And it's kind of like, lots of these teams would have brought lots of different groups of people together in so many different ways. Especially, there was like looking at one of the Cameroonian sides, and they call up a guy that's playing, I think it was like Nacham. I think he was playing in England. He was like one of the only English speaking players in the Cameroonian side. And it's interesting to hear like kind of how he talks about it. And especially now, like, if people know about Cameroon, there is this kind of conflict between the English speaking regions of Cameroon and the rest of the country, which goes way, way back to the kind of like post-World War II, when they're kind of deciding which part, like they could have joined Nigeria, but they end up staying with Cameroon. But it's kind of, you can't really talk about the tournament without it, because you've got these big characters like Kwame Nkrumah, you've got Mobutu, Colonel Gaddafi. I think a whole book could be written about Libya under Colonel Gaddafi and the football. His sons were always involved in football. He didn't he liked football in the sense that he liked the physical benefits of football, but he found watching it to be the most pointless thing ever. he writes in his green book, he was just like, it's such a waste of time. But then he goes and hosts the tournament and he's like, this is great, that boosts the image. Because Gaddafi's all about this kind of, he wants to be kind of the president of the United African kind of states or whatever it is. He's like always want to be kind of this like big leader in Africa, which he kind of was. But Libya then get to the final 82, they don't win, but then they just kind of disappear. They never really come back again. And it's kind of like, it's just fascinating that you can't ignore these guys. And then especially the 96 chapter, like it was quite, I was like, well, I can't do a whole history of apartheid in South Africa, because again, that's a whole book in itself, but you can't ignore how apartheid influences the football and then how story of the team is so kind of like, it's special because of the apartheid era makes that special, where you've got all these players coming together that wouldn't necessarily been able to play with each other. Especially when like football was considered more for like kind of the coloured in brackets South African, and then rugby was for the whites, whereas then some whites start to play football and then you bring them more together, and you have this amazing image in 96 in the final of like black, white South Africans sat together in the stadium hugging each other and celebrating, and you just think that wasn't allowed to happen for so many years. But then they come back and it's just like, yeah, it's just, the South Africa stuff is so interesting in another way as well, because it kind of, for me, that's where you see this kind of change in CAF over the years. Like a lot of people see CAF, and if you don't know who CAF are, they are the governing body of African football. And lots of people see them now as kind of basically best buds with FIFA, like them and FIFA are so close, African Super League, all that sort of stuff, like this close relationship. But originally CAF kind of comes out and it's very kind of like Pan-African, very kind of anti-colonial, very kind of like, kind of pushing back against FIFA in many ways at the beginning. And the South Africa case is the biggest kind of pushback that they have. And it's one of the reasons they are massively against Stanley Roux. He gets defeated, obviously, by Havelange in that 1974 election. And there's like this whole, he comes to one of the AFCON tournaments and basically tells them they have to let South Africa play. And they're like, there's no way we are doing that. They will only send a white team or they'll only send a black team. We will not allow that to happen at this tournament. So the South Africa chapter, you just can't ignore it. So hopefully like people will get a little bit of interest in that if they are interested in it, but it's not completely fully all about the politics. There's a lot about the football as well. But you just can't ignore certain elements of it because, yeah, like I said, like as the tournament develops, these countries are emerging and becoming part of the tournament. And it's because they're decolonizing constantly over time and things are happening constantly over time because of colonialization and kind of the after effects of that, which impact the tournament. So, for me, it's obviously fascinating, and I hope other people do find that quite interesting as well.
Yeah, I find it really fascinating. And I think that kind of creative choice of yours is one of my favourite things about the book. A lot of my favourite football books that I've read over the last few years have been ones that really have had a massive amount of politics in them. Because as we're saying again at the beginning, you can't separate football from politics. So, you know, to bring these narratives together, I think is really useful in storytelling terms as well. And is obviously one of the reasons why we read books kind of full stop. I mean, we've seen as well, you know, politicians have always been aware of the kind of societal impact of football, both in a positive and a negative way. You know, we've seen a lot of South American countries in the past as well, you know, under certain political regimes, using football in an overtly political way as well. And obviously that's very similar across Africa. And it's kind of really fascinating to learn more about that. I was teasing way back at the beginning about how we were going to celebrate the kind of close links between Belgian and African football, because this is not a new relationship. This is a very long-standing one, isn't it, Ben? And tell us a little bit more about that, because, you know, those who follow a little bit of Belgian football, or as much of it as certainly we do, will have heard of things like the Ebony Shoe, which is, of course, Belgium's annual award, which is given to the best player of African origin playing in Belgium in that year. So, you know, Belgian football has long recognised the importance of its African connection and its African roots. And, of course, there's a big element of, and you'll be able to tell us a little bit more about this, you know, the kind of colonial links as well are massive in here. Obviously, Belgium had its own kind of colonial empire up until relatively recently still, obviously the main one being the Belgian Congo between sort of 1908 and 1960, and then you've got control of what is now Rwanda and Burundi between the 20s and the early 60s, and then there's that little area, that province in South Sudan as well for a 15-20 year period. So colonialism is a big factor in the relationship, and then there's the migration. And I was just thinking about this today, actually, Ben, when I was doing a little bit of preparation, and I was forgetting how important this relationship is even now, because when you look at the Red Devils team even today, there are some real stars in there who are players of African origin who've chosen Belgium as their home. Many of them obviously have dual nationality, but obvious examples, Romelu Lukaku, Jeremy Doku, Amadou Onana, there are some massive Belgian superstars there who Belgium, you know, have benefited from the long-term historical effects of, you know, obviously the colonialism and family migration as well. And one other thing that did pop into my head today was Paul Bonga Bonga, of course, who is credited with being one of the first African footballers in Belgium. There's a little bit of doubt over the dates of that, of course, and in a way it doesn't matter, but Paul Bonga Bonga comes from DR Congo, playing for an African team. The famous story about that team playing Standard on a tour in Belgium, Standard going, oh, hello, this guy looks quite good. And before he knows where he is, he's joined Standard Liège in 1957, just before the Belgian Congo ends as a kind of colonial empire, spends 6 years playing for Standard Liège, then another four playing for Charleroi. And some people see him as being the spearhead to this story, but he isn't in a lot of ways. But yeah, there's so many interesting kind of links there. Tell us a little bit more about that, because we hint at it a lot, but don't get a chance really to talk about it.
Yeah, like Paul Bonga Bonga's like, yeah, one of the OGs, isn't he? He's kind of like one of the one that everyone talks about. And it's, I think, yeah, for people kind of going like back and back and back, like, so Belgium's relationship with the area, yeah, the Congo, is like, it's quite, I don't know how to say this nicely, in the sense like it wasn't great. Like, let's be honest, like, they weren't, from like kind of everything that I've read and the research I've done and kind of what I've learned over the years, like, it obviously was not, like, colonialism itself, in my opinion, was pretty pointless and terrible, and like a really, really awful thing to have happened, and was just so unnecessary. But we won't get into debates around like the all that sort of stuff. But when it comes to Belgium, you've obviously got King Leopold before Belgium actually takes over the Congo. King Leopold colonizes the Congo as his own personal fiefdom, basically. Like, it's nothing to do with the Belgian state. It's his. And there's like been a weird kind of renewal of the debate about whether he was doing it for like good reasons or bad reasons. But you just look at what happened during that time, like lots of kind of extrajudicial killings, kind of the way they treated the people that were living there, like created, again, an artificial state. Like the Congo, it's massive. The DR Congo, sorry, because obviously you've got the other Congo as well. It's such a big country, and it's like, it's just such an artificial state that they created that's now having to deal with the issues of what they created in terms of that. And then obviously, yeah, Belgium takes over. And kind of during that time, there's a fantastic book actually called Congo that if people are interested, they should definitely read, because there are elements of the football kind of side in there. You see like Union go over there and play a couple of games. Like you said, Scott, like Congolese teams would come over to Belgium and kind of do some touring and stuff like that as well. So there was always kind of this to and fro between the two. But then when independence comes, Belgium basically, from what I can remember, just kind of ups and leaves. They just get out And they just like, okay, yeah, here you go. Just deal with all the problems that we've created. Good luck. So then you get to Patrice Lumumba, very kind of a little bit more of a socialist in terms of wanting how he wanted to run the state. He then gets killed. Lots of people say that Mobutu and the CIA were involved in that one. Mobutu basically, when he takes over, that's like kind of where you see a really interesting dynamic in this kind of Belgium-Congolese kind of relationship. He decides if you want to play for the DRC or Zaire, as he calls them at the time, you need to live here, you need to play for a local team. So he actually buys some players back who have gone to Belgium. There was one man he actually couldn't afford, and you think that this man had the whole state behind him, but Julian Kialunda, who goes to Union and then he plays for Anderlecht. Mobutu actually, he couldn't afford him. They were asking for like 400 grand in today's money, and he just couldn't get him. He actually subsides and lets the man play for one tournament. So I don't think he plays in the World Cup, but he does play in the 1972 AFCON, which they don't win. I found him just a fascinating character. And I think he's got like a funny nickname as like the Pope of something, like a region in Brussels. He's called like the Pope of that region because he had like a nightclub and stuff like that. So he's like a fascinating character. But yeah, it's kind of with like kind of more looking at, I kind of like when you sent this question, I kind of like looked a little bit broader as well, in that it kind of tells the story of the tournament in the sense that those early years, a lot of those players are all domestic players. So obviously like Mobutu brings them back, and a lot of the players who played in the early tournament, like Congo, the DRC would take a team, Zaire would take a team, and they'd be very much based, most players would be based there. Nigeria would take a team of home-based players. But as kind of like structural adjustment and that sort of stuff comes in, and these countries start to struggle economically, the clubs can't pay these players what the European clubs can pay them. So initially the pay isn't, it's just not, the difference maker isn't there for these players to go and play for like a team that isn't massive and can afford to like bring them over. So like you did still get some players going over, and like, yeah, Kielunda going to play for Anderlecht, that's a big club, but they wouldn't go over and play for like a second division team in Belgium for less money than what they get at home. But then things really do start to change, and then you get what we now have, which is a complete flip of that, which is where most of the players that will go to AFCON would have come from Europe back to Africa to play in the tournament, which is what Belgium, but Belgium's always like, from what I've read, and like when I've looked at squads that have turned up at AFCON and stuff from like the 80s onwards, like lots of players can get, like, it's a lot more accessible to get there. Like Als, as I said, they just seem to have loads of these players. One player in particular, Kalusha Bwalia, the Zambian, he goes over to Circle of Bruges in the 80s. Literally, that saves his life from something that happens in the 90s. So many more than, as looking at other ones, Stephen Keshi played for Anderlecht, played lots of times for Anderlecht, won some trophies while he was at Anderlecht. Obviously then becomes a top-level coach. So people might not remember, he actually was the one that got Togo to the World Cup. He then gets sacked because of a really bad AFCON in 2006. They go to the World Cup and they're terrible without him anyway. He then wins AFCON 2013. Then he dies at the age of 54. And it's just, that was really tragic for me following his story. But again, massive links to Belgium there. Daniel Amokachi, another one of the Nigerian guys, scores the first ever Champions League goal. He plays for Club Bruges. There's just so many. There's so many kind of links between the two nations. And I think Belgium is a lot easier for African players, especially players from the DRC, to come to and then play. And then you mentioned as well the players that are there now. And there was that horrible kind of stuff that came out, wasn't it, when France won the World Cup, where everyone was like, oh, they didn't really win, they just got all these African players, blah. And it's like, if these players want to play for France and they feel they identify as French, then they... like within their rights to do that. If they want to go back and play for a country that they could represent Africa, they will have their rights to do that. Like,
yeah,
colonialism has kind of shifted this for them, and it's kind of, we see a lot more of these kind of diaspora call-ups, I think I like to kind of think of them as, where it's like Senegal did it a lot actually, where they just thought, well, why are we've got loads of these players that we could call up from France, they're actually really good, let's just bring them in, and that kind of massively changed their outlook. So it's really interesting, yeah, because like Lukaku's dad played for, I'm pretty sure he played for the DRC, a couple of other players like that could play for the DRC that haven't. But then there's also players that are playing for the DRC that could play for Belgium. So it's kind of like there's quite a mix there. between those two. And it's kind of, it's nice to see that go the other way, where players that could play for Belgium but are eligible to play for the DRC then go back to play for the DRC, because it's like, okay, like it's kind of a reverse flow of talent which can help this country, which is, has lost a lot of its footballing talent over the years because they've all like left and stuff. So yeah, I think that's, again, another reason why I've always been interested in Belgian football, especially for the last couple of years, is because you get lots of African players that come through. And we've seen it recently, and we'll talk a bit about it later, like players from countries that aren't the big countries either. There's lots of players from kind of these smaller African nations that can come to Belgium and make a name for themselves.
That's the thing about it as well, isn't it? Because it's like, you know, you're saying lots of young players get opportunities in Belgium, regardless of their nationality. Actually, it's one of the great things about Belgian football. It's a fantastic development league, one of the top ones in Europe. You know, those who know their stuff already know that. But I was thinking about this today as well, and when you think about where Belgium is located in Europe, it's very centrally located. Obviously, you know, you've got France next door, the Netherlands is next door, and essentially the whole of the rest of Central Europe is very easily accessible to you. It's a multilingual country, like a lot in Central Europe, and it has a generally very open society. So it's an incredible place to come if you're a young player coming from Africa and perhaps you don't even speak English yet, for example. You know, it's an ideal place to come learn the European game, because there are elements to European football that are very different tactically and physically to African football, obviously. That's a whole separate discussion. But it's a very, when you look at the bigger picture, it's a kind of perfect starting point, which is one of the reasons why there's this long historical relationship. And I was looking today, and I think there's between about 70 and 80, give or take a few, because I could have spent all day researching this, but there's round about 70 or 80 African players currently based in Belgium across the Pro League and the Challenger Pro League. And that's second only to France's League One at the moment. It's only been behind that for a few years. So this relationship is really, really important. And it's one of the great things about the book. The book's given us the perfect opportunity to talk about this in a little bit more detail. And the Moroccan population as well. I was having a conversation with another podcaster recently about the fact that Morocco is actually, and this was a conversation about the Red Devils, I was talking about how Morocco is the third largest community, non-Belgian community in Belgium, behind the Italian community, which is incredible. But then you've also got the Congolese community, Burundi, Mali, and beyond. You know, Africa is, you know, properly represented in Belgium, and you know those links now cannot be separated, and that obviously is a beautiful thing, not just culturally but in footballing terms. Since we are the BFP, we decided to have a little bit of fun actually with Ben, and what we've asked him to do, and this is going to be really interesting actually, I'm looking forward to hearing who he's chosen for this. I asked Ben to pick his three favourite African players who were based at some point in the Pro League. So these don't have to be current players, these are just African players who have passed through the Pro League at some point in their career. So who's your first choice, Ben?
Yeah, I thought I'd go for those that aren't in the league and those that kind of are kind of more my era, I guess we could say. Because otherwise, I could probably chuck in like a Kalusha Balia. There was another guy that popped up from Morocco, for Algeria, sorry. That's a very bad slip of the tongue, called Jamel Amani. He played for Antwerp for like 1 year, but his performance at the 1990 AFCON tournament, honestly, like if any Antwerp players, fans can tell me like what he did in Antwerp for a year, because I can't find any information about like how many appearances, if he made any or anything like that. But this guy was a baller. Like he was a proper baller in the central areas. But for me, yeah, kind of the top one I went for is Boubacar Barry or Copper Barry. He's just like, he's always been one of those players I've been fascinated by. And I don't know why, he's just quite a charismatic guy. And for people that don't know, he had a really good Pro League career, actually, like one of the kind of really, really strong African representatives in the Pro League with Beveren, and then with Lokeren, won a couple of cups as well. He was also kind of part of that golden generation of the Côte d'Ivoire, golden generation that just kept failing basically. And I think you can kind of call it a failure when you look at the likes of the players they have. And then you get to 2015, and he's not even starting. Then he comes on and starts the final because of an injury, makes some saves in the penalty shootout, scores the winning penalty. It's just kind of like, it's such a magical story. And I don't know, he just seems like one of those people that I just love to meet. I don't know, he just seems like a proper, like, fun character, like really energetic, really like loves the game, loves goalkeeping. And people say all goalkeepers are crazy, don't they? And I think Copper Barry kind of looks like he could have a little bit of the craziness in him, that you need to be a goalkeeper at the level he played at. So he's definitely my first one.
I didn't mean to interrupt you there, Ben. He's really interesting because not only is his story actually incredible, you know, which fits in with the, you know, crazy goalkeepers narrative, which I think is true. A lot of us would agree with that. He was at Leuven for a little while as well, very briefly at the end of his career. But I think he's got over 340 appearances in Belgian football, I think, something just a little over 340. But I think he's now, correct me if I'm wrong, is he not a goalkeeping coach now? I know he was at Leuven as a coach for a little while. He would then coach Ghent's under-21s, I think, for a year or so. And I think he's still at Lokeren now, isn't he? You know, which is kind of fitting as a Lokeren legend.
So I think, yeah, for the last time I read, he was at Lokeren. But I don't know if it's kind of hard to work out if he's still there or not. But he, in my mind, I can see him being quite enjoying the return of Lokeren. Because like you said, he was there for ages. And he made so many appearances, won some trophies. Like, it was a really real high point for the club. So yeah, he was definitely kind of number one for me. The second one is probably a name, if like long, long time listeners to this podcast from like when we first started will probably have remembered me like banging on about, which is Knowledge Musona. So Knowledge Musona, Zambian midfielder, attacker, winger, kind of whatever you want to put him, played for a whole host of teams in Belgium, Anderlecht, Lokeren as well, Erpen and Oostend. He had spells all over. He's kind of had some time in Germany as well, but Belgium, I think he kind of had his like real best time. Especially at Oostend, he played quite a bit. I think he's got like 41 goals for Oostend in 112 appearances, 39 goals, 123 games in the Pro League as well. So yeah, Knowledge for me, like Knowledge is one of like it's like as a kid, obviously quite stupid, but one of those people like you're playing kind of like FIFA with your mates. And we used to do this thing where you'd like randomize the teams. And once you did a hit a certain number, that was the team you had to be. And I'm pretty sure it probably was when he was at Lokeren or someone like Lokeren or Oostend that I like got them for one of our games or something. And you're just going through the squad and you see a man called Knowledge. And you're like, that's an incredible, name. An incredible, incredible name. And since then, I was just like, I'm fascinated by this player. Like, and then I actually watched some of his stuff and I was like, oh, this guy's great. Like, he's a lot of people when they talk about African players, it's all about power, pace, all that sort of like nonsense, but he was always quite technical, quite positionless as well. I found with him, like you could have had him as a striker, second striker, winger, central, like any of that sort of stuff. And he does get a mention in the book because I couldn't resist dropping him in when talking about Zimbabwe at some point. But yeah, I think 24 goals in 51 games for Zimbabwe. A couple of years at AFCON as well. Obviously, Zimbabwe have never really done anything at AFCON like kind of worthy of note in the sense of going far or anything. But he was always one of those that kind of was one of the reasons I followed Belgian football a little bit more and got into it as well, because I was like, oh, this guy's interesting. I'm interested in African football. Like, let's follow Knowledge's career and see kind of where he gets to. So he's now obviously gone to Saudi to get some money there, which fair play when you're 33 and you get given that opportunity. You can't really blame him for doing that. But yeah, Knowledge is definitely my second one. He had a very good Pro League career.
He's really interesting because obviously he's quite a recent memory for lots of us. And obviously he's still playing, as you were saying, he's in Saudi Arabia just now with Al Riyadh, I think, isn't he? He comes to Belgium in sort of 2015, joins Oostend, has a really good period at Oostend, as you were saying, then gets a big move to Anderlecht. Unfortunately, things didn't really work out for him there. But you know, Anderlecht's downside was obviously Lokeren and Erpen's gain, because he has a couple of loan spells there and continues to entertain us there. You mentioned Knowledge now being in Saudi Arabia, which is a wonderful link, I think, to a player who's your third choice, isn't it?
Yes, I thought I'd go for someone that is kind of from the era of the podcast. I thought I've got to pick someone from the era of the podcast. So I had kind of two names kind of penciled in, one more for his AFCON exploits and one more for his Pro League exploits. So the AFCON one that I didn't go with the name was Abdi Jallo, the Gambian midfielder. Obviously, did really well in the Challenger Pro League, whatever it was called back in the day, 1B, when Selang got promoted. And he had a reasonably good kind of Pro League couple of seasons. But for Gambia in their first AFCON, he scored a really, really good goal to win them a game. But I went for Faiz Selemani. He was obviously a bit controversial in certain circles in Belgian football, but he, to me, like, he's the reason Kortrijk stayed up last season. Goal out of nowhere, just the way he kind of played. And again, him, like I mentioned to you, like we mentioned earlier, didn't we, about kind of like the different type of nations that come to play in kind of Belgian football. And he obviously is representing the Comoros Islands, which is just their fascinating story. Like, such a small country just off the east coast of Africa that suddenly turns up at AFCON, and they're just so entertaining. And obviously he's one of those entertainers, like he's a fantastic entertainer. And if people remember, they get to that kind of quarter or last 16 game against the host Cameroon without any goalkeepers because of COVID tests and all that, which I'm sure there's some kind of like some people out there who think that probably wasn't quite legitimate. In terms of, oh, suddenly the host nation's playing a team without any goalkeepers. Then they stick the defender, Chaka Al-Hadur, in goal, who unfortunately doesn't have a Belgian connection. But funny enough, his shirt, that, so basically, and if people have seen it, it's like sticky taped the number onto the back of like one of the goalkeeper shirts. And then they stuck, used like tape to make his name. That shirt's actually in the FIFA museum. So if you go to the museum, they've like framed the shirt and it's up there. Mm-hmm. He donated it to them. So that's quite, was quite hilarious. But yeah, Selemani obviously left the league this last summer, and I think if he was still there, you'd give Kortrijk a chance of staying up. He was that good for them. He was kind of like their talismanic player, and I just loved watching him play. So yeah, definitely Selemani, Abdi Jallo. There's quite a few, but I thought I'd go with those three because they're not in the league anymore. And we'll probably speak about some guys in the league eventually, I'm sure.
Yeah. We'll get round to them shortly, actually. Funnily enough, you know, you're reading my mind about what's coming next. Selemani is actually a really good choice, I think, because not only is he recent, as you were saying, Ben, but he could still be in Belgium, which from our selfish point of view is quite frustrating. You know, he almost landed on our Joris's team, Genk, in the summer, but circumstances, you know, conspired against everybody. And, you know, Fayez has actually said publicly on more than one occasion now that he kind of regrets that. So I'm sure he's having a great time in Saudi Arabia, you know, both on the pitch and off it. But from our point of view, it's a shame that he's not now at Genk, so we can still watch him every week. Of course, those who will have followed his career will know a little bit about the controversy around his, initially in Belgium, he plays for Union Saint-Gilloise, of course, between 2018 and 19. There's then a massive falling out, which leads to him being sent to the B squad, which he didn't take very well. He unilaterally terminates his own contract. And to be fair, he's not the first player who's gone down this road in Belgium, as controversial as it is. Then signs for Kortrijk, spends a few years there, does very well, as we know. So a bit of controversy mixed in there with a brilliant player. But we often see that with talent like that. So it's not really, really unusual. Just to bring this full circle for a second, and, you know, you were right there, actually. You just were about to start talking about some of the current African players in the Pro League. Who would you say are the current African-based Pro League players that we should be kind of watching out for at AFCON in the next couple of weeks?
Yeah, I think you'll probably know exactly who I'm going to go with first, and it has to be Mohamed Amoura, doesn't it? Like, the guy's just destroying Belgian Pro League defenders. And I think he's suspended for the first game I saw the other day from some Algerian sources. But like, when he comes back, I think he really could have such a good tournament, because he's just so kind of for me, he is like almost like an atypical Algerian player. And he plays with a lot of passion. He plays with a lot of like kind of effort and energy and that sort of stuff. And like when you watch kind of Algerian football and you look at the fans and you look at kind of how the nation historically like had to fight against the French and this sort of stuff, like there's like this deep rooted passion about being Algerian that they have. And it comes across in their football teams, which is why the previous couple of tournaments when they haven't done well, it's been really weird, because I've always found with them, I'm like, even if they're not playing well, you feel like they're always in the game because they're not going to give up. And I feel like Amoura doesn't, like he chases everything. He chases lost cause. He does all that. And I think even if he doesn't start games, I think Rabadi will bring him on and he'll see like this guy is going to change games for us, because yeah, you just think that you've got him feeding off of like Mahrez and people like that. Like the guy's going to score some goals at AFCON, surely. Like, are we shocked if he doesn't? So everyone, I think, who listens to this podcast knows like Mohamed Amoura is one to watch, like for sure. And people that listen to this podcast can then tell their mates, like, you got to watch this Algerian kid. Like, he is something special. Herve Coffee, like, I'm a big fan. Obviously, the cat, the Burkina Faso keeper. I don't know. He was injured last time we saw him, like, hobbling off. So hopefully he's going to be okay. I haven't read anything. He came, obviously, playing for Burkina Faso. Like, from the book, for me, I've always kind of had a soft spot for Burkina Faso since 2012. Where they make the final with one of my favorite ever strikers in Aristide Bantse. But now there's like a new look Burkina Faso team, him in goal. They've got some other really nice pieces. And I wanted them to win in 2013, but obviously Stephen Keshi, our good friend from Anderlecht, decided that Nigeria are going to win that one. But I'm hoping Coffee has a good tournament. I think he finished like the last game he played for Charleroi, he looked really, really much better than he has done previously. He was making actually some acrobatic saves, which is what he's kind of his calling card is those kind of ridiculous saves that kind of you're like, wow, that was exciting to watch. So hopefully he gets a chance to do that. I guess the football hipster in me is probably going to be watching, and you probably would as well, Scott, in the CPL hipster in you is Guinea-Bissau, because obviously they've got two CPL guys, Uprarina Di Gioco of Frankfurt at the goalkeeper, and then Mr. Zeno Gano of Zulte Waregem. I don't think Gano will start. I'm not sure about Gioco. I have to say I haven't watched much Guinea-Bissau in recent times. I don't know who their number one choice goalkeeper is. I just can't imagine Zeno Gano will start, but it'd be cool to see him come off the bench and maybe do some stuff. Like, you know, with him, he probably will be able to, he could grab them a goal or two off the bench, but I don't think his level is kind of high enough for AFCON. Like, I think you see some really great strikers at AFCON, and you also see some strikers who are like not great outside of African football, like domestically, but then they'll come to AFCON and light it up. But maybe Gano will do well, but Guinea-Bissau I think we'll definitely be watching for sure. And then who else have on my list? Mori Konate. That was the last one I thought. It would be interesting to watch a bit of Mori Konate. Guinea, always, people that read the book will see Guinea pop up constantly throughout the book, but they have no dedicated chapter because they've just never won it, despite having some really, really good teams. And I don't know, you obviously being the Mechelen fan, Scott, but for me, in the past few weeks, Mori Konate's been looking like that. He's really getting back to full fitness, really getting back to some good performances. And I think he could be really good for Guinea, especially in games where they want to play kind of a little bit more defensively on the counter. But even like other times, whether if they want to kind of dominate games, I think he kind of offers both, because if they want to sit back deeply, he can kind of pick up the passing lanes and stuff. But if they want to play more attacking, he can just sit deep, recover the ball for them and then recycle it to do that. And I think that's what he's been doing a little bit more for Mechelen, which I've really, really liked, is like Scoofs doesn't have to come back and do much defending because Konate is going to do all of that stuff. Scoofs just comes back and fouls people, but Konate like recycles the ball, picks it up and gives it on. So I'm hoping we'll see a bit of him in this tournament. I'm hoping Guinea will do well. Like Burkina Faso, Guinea, and there's another team I'll talk about maybe a little bit later, like these kind of, there's three countries that I'd really like to win it, just because from doing the book, these are countries that I felt like, oh, they've always come so close, but never quite managed to get over the line.
Yeah, some really interesting choices there. Another one I'm going to fling in, just because, you know, he's very hot at the moment, is Genk's Bilal Alkunus. Improving at a staggering rate at the moment. And, you know, the the line breaking passes and the kind of progressive runs he's really added to his game. He's really kicking on at the moment, and you know, he's the sort of exciting young player who I think, you know, given enough game time at the tournament, could be really worth watching. And you mentioned Herb Coffey as well. I think he's going to be okay. I think a little bit of recuperation should see him okay for the tournament. I find it quite funny. I think it was yesterday, Charleroi, who are his club in Belgium, of course, for those of you who know, tweeted a YouTube link to a compilation of all of his best saves while at Charleroi, which I thought was in many ways a brilliant celebration of the cap, but also the perfect send-off to G him up for the tournament as well. Go and check that, everybody, because that's going to give you a little insight into hopefully what you're going to see him doing at the tournament kind of proper. Speaking of the tournament proper, we know it's in the Ivory Coast, Ben, and it starts on the 13th. Tell us a little bit more about the kind of the build up to it. How do you see this tournament going? And for you, who's winning, or who do you hope to win?
Yeah, they are two different questions, aren't they? I think it's been an interesting time for African football with kind of the launch of the African Super League, like all that sort of stuff. Like it is kind of, it feels like there's going to be lots of eyes on the tournament because it's a lot more accessible than it has been in the past. Like more and more people are paying attention because there's more and more of these top level players like Mane, Salah, all these guys kind of being there. And I think Morocco's World Cup exploits will definitely have helped as well. And I think they will probably be favourites because of that. But kind of looking with like the historical like hat on, it doesn't always mean anything having a good World Cup before an AFCON. Like Ghana had that incredible World Cup in 2010, haven't won the tournament for ages. It just didn't mean anything. So I don't know. It's kind of, when you think about it, the Morocco go into the World Cup with little pressure on them because there's no expectations that they're going to make a semi-final. Like they probably did internally believe like we are good enough, like player-wise they're good enough, but there's no expectations on them. But now they're coming into a domestic or a continental tournament where everyone's going to be like, well, you guys should probably win this now. And you've only won it once. So there's a lot of pressure on Morocco. And that's why I'm interested to see what they do. Like will Bilal Kanous play? Like will he play a lot of times? Because he could really make a difference for them in terms of coming off the bench and opening up some teams and stuff like that. And then they've got Tissou Dali as well. We don't know how much he's going to feature because obviously I'm a big fan of Tissou Dali, but I didn't want to mention him because I just don't know how much he's going to play given the talent that they've got there. It's quite a difficult site to get into. So they've got a lot of pressure on them. I think, yeah, all the kind of the North African teams you're looking at thinking they've got a chance. Like Algeria, they just have so much talent. They've got a good coach. They really should be pushing on to kind of get another title here. Egypt owe it to Mo Salah to win it for him, to like actually put some good performances in around him, because he does, like they do just rely on him dragging them through. Although to be fair, Trezeguet, the ex-Villa guy, and I think he's now playing in Turkey, isn't he? He always is pretty good for Egypt, in my opinion. In the tournament, he'll pop up with the odd goal. So you got to kind of look at them. And then, then you've probably got to talk about Senegal. Although I don't know. I just have a feeling Senegal won't defend their title this time. It's such a difficult tournament to defend. And even though it's every 2 years, it just seems to be like things change so quickly. And no one's defended it for a very long time since Egypt did it in the 2000s. So those are kind of the teams I've put up there in terms of kind of who I think could win it. Mainly the North African teams, I think, have the best chance. On a personal note, who do I want to win? I'd love to see Burkina Faso win. I'd love to see Guinea win. And one team I'd actually love to see win are Mali. Mali have always been, again, another team. They make semi-finals and then they just fall short. They fall short so often and it's just so frustrating, and especially when they had the great Seydou Keita, the Barcelona midfielder. Lots of people know Seydou Keita and have watched Seydou Keita, and just watching some of his performances at AFCON, you're like, this man just deserved to win it at least once, get to the final at least once. Like there was one game I think in 2010 where they're 4-1 down to Angola with like minutes left and they draw 4-4, and he's just like dragging them up the pitch and getting things done for them. So Mali, They're quite an unknown in terms of, I don't think they have the top level talent that other teams have, but they have a great shirt. So maybe the great shirt will be the inspiration to go there. But Those are kind of the teams I focused on. And then there's, from like my opinion, there's always, you've got to kind of always consider two teams in terms of Tunisia and Cameroon. Like Tunisia haven't won it. They've only won it once, obviously, 2004, but they're just very, very good at getting through the group stages, playing really dross football. That's just their calling card. Really boring nil-nils that they grind it out, and then they get into the knockouts, and they have this kind of belief that they will win games and they can grind teams out. And then Cameroon as well. I don't think you can ever count a Cameroonian side out of an AFCON tournament. I think they, like a couple of years ago, I think it was 2017 or maybe a little bit around that sort of time, where loads of players said we're not coming because we don't want to leave off clubs. The team that did turn up went on to win it. And it's kind of like that sort of like, you just can't ever write Cameroon off, especially in the Côte d'Ivoire. Côte d'Ivoire could have a good tournament as well. Like, they've got a strong team. But I think this is one of those tournaments where it is really, really open. Senegal were the favourites last time, but I don't think they are this time. And I think Morocco were the favourites, but I think it's so evenly spread. It should be a fascinating tournament. And I'm hoping we get a new winner, because it's always great to get a new winner. Although it would be frustrating because I'd have missed out on putting them in the book. But maybe... an extra chapter later to kind of, if Mali win, I can then do the Mali chapter that I really wanted to do, but they just never won, so I couldn't do it.
There you go. You heard it here first, folks. There will be a reprint in the future. You know, there's classic updated editions. Because, I mean, I certainly hope that this book is going to become a classic on the topic, because, you know, it's pretty special. And one of my memories of it, you know, as a kid of this tournament, watching it, is seeing this kind of faraway land, players I'd never heard of, you know, getting to experience, albeit through the filter of television, cultures that, you know, don't get any exposure to to any real degree, unless you get to meet somebody from that country. So there was something tremendously exciting about it as a young football fan when I was a kid, and also not knowing a lot about the countries or the teams. So there was this sense of not knowing who was going to win. You kind of knew who the kind of the big boys were historically, like you do, you know, with World Cups and European Championships. But the tremendous sense of the unknown with this tournament, and you talking about it being open there, it sounds like, you know, we are back in an era again where almost anything is possible. And that's one of the many reasons why you should certainly watch this tournament. And speaking of watching it, because we're bound to get asked this, and you know, we do want to let people know how to do this, because, you know, you really should watch the tournament. How are people going to be able to watch it, Ben?
So I'm pretty sure it should all be on YouTube through Sky. I think they're going to show most of the games, although take that with a pinch of salt, because they've like absolutely butchered the coverage last time out, until people clamoured for them to actually get co-commentators on. Because I can't remember who the commentator was. It was this poor guy just having to do all the games, like two of them, I think, doing all the games without anyone to bounce off of. And I can imagine that I've done a solo podcast for like one of these things, and it's just quite horrible just speaking to yourself for 90 minutes. So fingers crossed they'll get, I think they got, I don't know, maybe they'll bring out Leroy the senior, or just someone with actual knowledge of the tournament is always quite nice. Especially like an ex-player that's played in the tournament, like represented one of these countries, because there's plenty of them out there that could do the job. So fingers crossed it will be kind of good viewing. The football should be, that's for sure. And there's going to be some fantastic podcasts, I'm sure, following the tournament as well. So you can definitely keep up to date with what's going on. BBC Sport actually does have a very good section on African football. Ola Washina is a fantastic reporter, so he's definitely worth checking out if you're interested in kind of checking up on what's going on. So I think Sky for that, and then kind of check out some of the kind of the local reporters and stuff like that, because they usually know exactly what's going on, and some of the times the rest of us don't have a clue. Over here, kind of a continent away, it can be quite difficult to know, but they've got their ear to the ground. So hopefully it'll be good coverage this year, but you never know.
Yeah, we understand at the moment, and as Ben was saying, this might change, but as of the moment, just a little bit over a week ahead of the tournament, Sky Sports in the UK are planning to show every game. But if that doesn't materialise, then the AFCON YouTube channel, as Ben was saying, is planning to show the entire tournament live as well. So if you're in the UK and you don't have Sky Sports, then that is your best option. But thankfully, there are a few options because there was a period not that long ago, Ben, was there, where it looked like nobody was going to be sure, you know, how anyone was going to be able to watch it anywhere.
Yeah, no, there was a whole... Well, CAF kind of ripped up their contract with, Sports. Yeah, they just... That was all very confusing. It seems like they had a... Everyone was like, what is their plan, basically? What are they going to do with this tournament? Yep. Like, why are they making these decisions so late? And I think sometimes you just got to sit back and be like, okay, something will be... It'll be worked out eventually. Even if it's on the day, we'll get there. Like, even with that, I was trying to watch some of the African Super League and I just could not get that flipping stream to load at all. But eventually it works. So a little bit of patience and we'll probably be fine. But as long as we can watch all the games, that's all I care about. Although it's going to be very difficult juggling the Belgian stuff with the AFCON and trying to remember who I'm talking about. But maybe we can have a little update section on how everyone's doing during the regular episodes.
Yeah.
I'll keep an eye out on how our Belgian-based lads are doing over there.
Yeah, that's definitely something we've done in the past as well. And I know that's been a lot of fun for you because I know you like to do a lot of tweeting or have done during past tournaments as well, kind of updating everyone on how our Belgian stars are doing at the tournament. In terms of the book, where do people find you on social media and where can they get hold of the book?
Yeah, so obviously if you follow our account, hopefully you know how to follow us. But if you don't follow the Belgian Football Podcast and you just listen to this episode, it's at BenJack94 on X or Twitter, whatever you want to call it now. Just buying the book, yeah, you can pretty much buy it from any bookshop you want, or you can go directly to Pitch Publishing. Yeah, obviously, I feel like I should give a bigger, I guess, shout out to Pitch now for obviously letting me run with this. The process is very, very easy. They've been very kind of very, very easy to work with throughout the whole thing. And it's great kind of knowing that you can hand over your work to someone, and you know that they're going to really check through it and really kind of put in the quality. Because like we said at the beginning, they are publishing some really, really quality pieces. So if you're kind of, you may be what I was to the James Kelly interview that you're listening to this, you're thinking, yeah, I'd love to go write a book. Like if you've got a footballing book idea, just take it to Pitch and just kind of give them the idea and kind of let them help you kind of mold it and scope it into something that can become like a reality, because it is a great thing to do. And I think there's so many stories out there, footballing history and kind of stuff like that. And in recent times, we're really getting more and more people that it's more accessible to write and it's more accessible to get your stuff published because there are people like Pitch who are willing to give you the time of day, whereas this was a closed shop before. So yeah, if you've got an idea about Belgian football as well, like there's some great stories that you could write. Anything, I think it's just, yeah, there's so much good stuff out there that you could do. And I think if you are feeling like you want to start writing, like please feel free to get in touch if you want so many like kind of tips and stuff. I'm more than happy to let you know from my mistakes and all that sort of stuff, because yeah, there's plenty that you make along the way, but it's really rewarding at the end to kind of, and I guess the kind of the final thing for me is that you actually enjoy the research side of it as a football fan, because you get to watch old games, you get to learn stuff at the same time as writing it and giving it to other people. So yeah, you're doing the hard work for everyone else, but it's totally rewarding at the end of the day.
Yeah, fantastic. And I've really enjoyed actually being able to kind of pick up this apart with you, Ben, because you know we allude to African players and the relationship we've been talking about for, you know, over the past hour a lot on the BFP. So to finally get a chance to do a special to celebrate the launch of the book has been really, really good. And I know you're going to be really busy, I suspect, over the next couple of weeks as people's copies start to, you know, arrive through those letterboxes, and people get in touch with you to talk to you about the book. That's just about it. For this particular BFP special. If you like what we do, please do consider leaving us a review on your podcast platform of choice. It helps new people find us and is a nice thing to do. Also, we do currently have a Buy Me a Coffee, which for those of you who don't know, allows you, if you enjoy our work, to kind of support us by making a small contribution that allows us to help keep the running costs of the BFP going. So if you'd like to make a wee contribution to our Buy Me a Coffee, you can do that by following the link on our bio on our social media as well. Take care of yourself, Ben. I will speak to you shortly, obviously, but I suspect you're going to be very busy, as I was saying, for the next little while. And to all of our listeners, stay safe, everybody, and we'll be back with you soon after the Pro League winter break. We'll be back for our weekly BFPs. So until then, take care, stay safe, and we'll speak to you soon on another episode of the Belgian Football Podcast.